Hi, everybody. Welcome to Colton Corner, Lafayette's Interfaith Podcast. I'm Lisa Green, Interfaith Fellow and about to be graduating senior, which is really crazy. I actually haven't said that yet. And I am here, so excited to be joined by Professor Phillips, head of the English department. And Professor Phillips, thanks so much for being here. And if you could just tell anybody who doesn't know a little bit about yourself and maybe how you would describe your faith tradition as well.
Yeah, and thanks so much, Lisa, for having me on. This is, you know, I feel very honored, you know, getting to get this spotlight moment. So I'm Chris Phillips. I use he, him pronouns. I am head of the English department currently and have been here now 17 years.
Wow.
And I would describe my faith tradition as Presbycatholic. You know, we'll get a little bit into what all this means, but basically I have deep roots in both Protestant and Catholic Christian traditions.
Wow.
And those have both stayed with me in how I currently live and express my faith.
That's so cool. Is that was that always how it was in your life?
No, that's really kind of layers from a number of, you know, different moments in my life. So my parents grew up Southern California evangelicals in the baby boomer era. My dad went to a huge evangelical free church in Pasadena.
Wow.
My mom was Baptist in Orange County, and they met at a Christian college. And they had different ideas of what they were going to do. My mom was actually going to be a missionary. And then she married a man who hated to travel. So that kind of, you know, took care of that. They both went into education. And then through one turn and another, my dad wound up becoming a pastor in the Covenant Church, which is kind of, you could think of it as an evangelical cousin of the Lutherans. It was started by Swedes around the turn of the 20th century. And so when I was born, he was stepping into that. He was a pastor in the Covenant Church up until my sixth grade year. And at that point, he started a little independent church that kind of limped along for a few years. And once that ran its course, we started attending a Presbyterian church out in California. Mm-hmm. And that became my new home, my new identity. Then I went to the same Christian college that my parents did, Westmont College in Santa Barbara, California.
Wow.
And met a good Catholic girl.
And
who got really tired of people asking her what she was doing there, because this was a non-denominational evangelical school.
Wow.
And it was kind of the most open of the evangelical schools at that time. You know, this was before there were lots of litmus tests about homosexuality, about abortion, a lot of these other things. I mean, people would assume, but it wasn't like, you know, you get knocked in or out of the society. You know, this was evangelicalism in the 90s was a very different thing, although you can certainly, you know, see the trajectory. And yeah, she was one of maybe a dozen practicing Catholics on campus.
Wow.
And that was really, for us, the big thing we had to work through when our relationship was developing, because we would seek out advice from married couples who came from interfaith backgrounds, and we would ask, how did you make this work? And the answer was invariably, well, A cared more than B, and so we go to A's community. And both of us were pretty committed to where we came from, and we were pretty knowledgeable about, like, we had good reasons why we wanted to be where we were.
Right.
And so, you know, figuring out compromise was tricky. It was clear that we weren't just going to give one up for the other. And we reached a point where we decided, okay, we trust each other enough. We are committed enough to the essentials together in terms of what it means to be a family of faith, in terms of how we support each other through our life with God, our life with the communities that we're in, that we were willing to get married and we will figure this out as we go. First year of marriage, that meant going to a Lutheran church. So we thought, okay, let's see if we can meet in the middle. It turns out that was not the solution.
Is that the middle?
Well, Not really, but so the fun thing with that was the organist and music director at that church was my wife's old piano teacher.
Aww.
When we first got married, we spent the first year of our marriage in her hometown. Mm. And this was all out in California. And after a year, we said, you know, this was great. Like, we got to sing in the choir. We had a really good experience. But I was moving on to graduate school, and we were like, okay, this is not home for us. Like, this is not where we want to be. And over the course of my grad school years, it happened at different times for each of us, but we wound up deciding, you know what, I want to join your church.
Aww.
And this was in the Bay Area in California. I was at Stanford for my grad school.
Wow.
And we attended a Presbyterian church and a Catholic church that were literally across the street from each other in Menlo Park, California. And as we were discerning all of this and trying to figure out what we were going to do, and we start making this move toward membership, where, you know, we're both members of good standing and where we came from, and now we want to add a membership. And the response we got from pastors at both churches was, well, this isn't really the way it's supposed to go, but we totally get why you're doing it, and we support where you're going with your faith journey, that, you know, we think this is a really beautiful thing. And so we will go ahead and allow that. And so this is one of these things that there were a lot of, I would say, I would use the word miracles to, like, how I wound up at Stanford. Like, I never thought I would be at a school like that. And to be where we were at that particular moment, like, I've talked to a lot of other people who said, yeah, if you weren't in the Bay Area, you probably wouldn't have found churches that would let you try out this dual citizen kind of approach. And so by the time we moved out here, once I was done with grad school and took the job at Lafayette, our first kid had arrived. He was 3 months old when we got here. And so, yeah, lots of life changes going all at once. But we said, okay, we want to keep the two church thing going. Yeah. And it took a little while to find places that felt right for us. Mm-hmm. And by the time we had our second child, who it turns out had a penchant, once he was really mobile, he loved to vault over the back of the pew during the service. We said, okay, I think we can manage one service per weekend. We're not going to, you know, stay in two. And so at that point, for various reasons, attending the Catholic Church was where we decided we needed to be. And we went to St. James out in the west side of Easton for that. We have since wound up coming back to College Hill Presbyterian Church, which we had attended before. Yeah. And I loved coming, like, when we came back, we didn't have any, like, where have you been? What's going on? Like, people were just happy to see us, really welcoming, you know, bringing it. And it was like, okay, yes, this is what we need. And so we have various times where we might go to Catholic services, but now we're pretty well settled in the life of College Hill Presbyterian. And that's been really, really great for us.
Wow, that was amazing. I feel like I have no response other than applauding, because I don't know that I've ever seen a summary quite like that. Like, usually, you know, I ask questions to kind of guide, and we might be done. I'm like wow, like, that was your whole journey.
Yeah, it's a lot.
I loved it. I was like, this could be a movie. That was incredible. And I have so many little points where I'm like, I don't know where to even start. Like, that was fantastic. The part I'm most drawn to, I've got to say, maybe from a, you know, empathetic way, because it's really something I'm going through right now with the interfaith relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I get, for one thing, starting at the beginning, where in college did you and your wife meet?
So we met, early in my sophomore year, her junior year. So she was, you know, a year ahead of me. Oh. And I was friends with one of her roommates. We had this setup where most people lived in dorms at our college, and there were a few of these essentially cottages, like kind of like the Monroe houses. And she was in one of those with a couple of friends. I had met her other two roommates, but hadn't met her yet. And so we hung out for an evening. And the funny thing is, I met another one of her friends, and she and I were the ones that talked the whole night. And my future wife just basically sat there and listened because we were, she was an American, The person I was talking to was an American history nerd. I was an American lit nerd. And so we were just kind of nerding, and she's into both of those. But, you know, she's a really remarkable person. One of the things that's remarkable about her is that she's actually quite extroverted, but in a quiet way. Like, she loves hanging out with people, but she does not want to be the center of attention. So if she can, be in the middle of a circle of friends and just kind of, you know, engage at various points while and just be in the mix of all of the goodness and all of the fun and, you know, what people are doing. Aww. Like, that's her happy place.
Yeah.
For me, as an extroverted introvert, I love nerding out with people, and then I retreat to my little
corner. That's me. That's me. Yeah. I was like, I love being in the center of attention, and I need a nap.
Yep, totally hear that.
Yeah, wow. That's so cool. See,
yeah, like a perfect... so we met back then. Yeah. We actually, that next semester, we had a PE requirement at our college, and one of the options was a ballroom swing class.
That sounds so fun.
The dance instructor was actually a good friend of my parents. They'd known each other since the 70s through various means. And so I thought, okay, I'd love to take a class with her. And this was also, like, Southern California in the late 90s, swing was it.
Really?
Like, that was what you did on, you know, just about any night of the week, actually. So, Big Bad Voodoo Daddy was from Santa Barbara, where I was going to college. They were one of the big 90s swing bands. It was just like, yeah, of course we're going to learn how to do swing dance. And it turns out that my wife was in the same class, and we're like 10 inches height difference. So it got a little bit interesting learning some of the dances, but, you know, and of course in a class like that, you're dancing with all kinds of folks, but it's like, you know, once we were dating, it's like, well, we already know, you know, basic swing steps. We know how to waltz. We know, you know, some of these other kinds of, and so that was kind of cool. That was something we really enjoyed in our earlier years. And, then we also, the class that became really more of a bonding thing for us was we took a class called Contemplative Reading.
Wow.
With a professor who is still a dear friend of ours, named Marilyn McIntyre. And this was the first time I ever experienced an ungraded course, which that term didn't even exist yet.
Basically,
the first day... the professor said, well, if you complete the work, you get an A. Like, this is not about grades here. We're doing a lot of journaling. And this was also pitched as an advanced seminar for English majors. So I'd been, you know, at that point, even though I was halfway through college, I was deep into my English major. My wife had just added her English major. And the professor said the first day, well, you've learned how to take a text apart. I'm going to teach you how to sit with one. And that class was, as cliche as it is to say, life-changing. It was absolutely incredible. And so that had kind of set the stage for the next semester. Started my junior year, we both went on a semester to England together through our college. And this was, you know, classic Christian college kind of proportions. It was 6 guys and 17 girls.
Wow.
Yeah, that was kind of the school ratio. It was, you know, frequent topic of comment and satire and, you know, all kinds of other things.
Funny.
Yeah, like it just a whole thing. Because a lot of folks, particularly, I don't think it's probably changed all that much, but at that point, a lot of families were sending kids, and especially their daughters, to those kinds of schools because they wanted them to meet the right kinds of spouses. So it's like they need to be in the tradition, they need to be getting a good degree so they can go on to some, you know, a great career and so on and so forth.
Wow.
It was strange. It was, you know, the lots of jokes about getting your
ring
MRS
by spring,
degree and,
yeah,
you know, all this kind of thing. And and, you know, the irony for us was we had not been at all interested in each other the whole time that we'd known each other. And she was in her last semester of college. She was getting ready to go home, start student teaching. She was going to be an elementary school teacher.
Oh.
I had 3 more semesters to go, and I was going to go to law school. And yeah, so lots of things changed from that point. And she, she and I just kind of figured out right at the end of the semester, like literally the night before finals week, that we were interested in each other. And so we had, this is a term I haven't heard a lot of people use for a long time, but then we called it the DTR, the Define the Relationship talk. And
I was just talking about this.
So that was a whole thing. We had our first date in London.
Wow.
So we went to see a play at the Old Vic out by Waterloo Station. It was a revival of Amadeus with Salieri was played by David Suchet, who is one of my favorite character actors ever. And then Mozart was played by this 19-year-old that nobody had heard of, but he was getting rave reviews, named Michael Sheen, who said, like, he played Tony Blair in The Queen.
That's so funny.
Was in the The Good Omens.
He's huge,
like,
I feel like.
Yeah, like, Michael Sheen is just kind of this, you know, major influence in British theater and film and all this kind of thing. And we got to see him right when he was, like, our age. It was, it was just this teenager just kind of tearing it up on the stage. And so we would get those, you know, relationship guides early in our marriage that would say, well, recreate your first date. It would be so fun. It's like, well, good luck doing that. You know, even if we went to see a different play, like how many thousands of dollars would we have to spend just to go back to London?
And, yeah. You
know, we'd eaten at this little hole in the wall Italian place on Fleet Street. You know, we'd, walked along the riverside to meet up with some friends by the Houses of Parliament to watch Big Ben strike midnight because it was our last night of the program. So, and then it's like, okay, we're off to our long-distance relationship and all that kind of thing.
Wow, so, and you just realized.
We had just figured this
out. You know each other like close to a year.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that helps get me ready for that was a big element of that semester for me was I had never been out of the country before. Mm-hmm. I had been in my various flavors of what I thought of as evangelical Protestantism. Like one of the big things for me when I moved out here was realizing that Presbyterians are not actually evangelical. In California, I basically thought that they were. And out here, it's like, no, it's much more of the mainline. Kind of, so you know, the more traditional, you know, the robed pastor is one symbol of that, but just, you know, more liturgically minded, more insistent on Calvinism, you know, those kinds of things. And, you know, even though I wouldn't necessarily say that's where College Hill Press is at this point, that was the overall vibe I was getting, was that, you know, the fact that this is a hundreds years long tradition coming out of Scotland and all that mattered a lot more in Pennsylvania than it did in the West Coast churches that I've been in.
Really? Well, right, because I think of evangelicalism as very strict and very, you know, and Presbyterian I think of as much more relaxed.
Right, yeah. So it was much more like, I went to a lot of what you might call blended services growing up, where it's like we're singing hymns, but we also have guitars. It's like, you know, it's all kind of happening at once. And then you did have like more contemporary services, and I tended to prefer the more traditional ones. Mm-hmm. And that was part of, you know, going to England, getting to experience Anglicanism for the first time.
Right.
And, you know, going to an Evensong, which, you know, at first I was going to just as a performance, like these amazing choirs who are just randomly singing in the evening. Like, I don't know why they're doing this, but it's really fun to, you know, at the end of a busy day of sightseeing, you just stop in, you listen to this great music, and that's really cool. And there are some prayers, and that's cool too. And, you know, so, but yeah, just starting to realize, okay, like this is what it means to have a common liturgy, a liturgical calendar that has something to say any time of the year. It's not just about Christmas and Easter. Realizing that there are saints that the Anglican Church really looks up to, which had not been part of my experience before. And so towards the end, when Emily and I went to my first Catholic masses together, it's like, okay, I kind of get what's going on, because I've gotten to see Anglican services and realizing that, you know, there are things that I'm picking out from the liturgy, from the prayers, that are very familiar to me, and other things that I've never seen before. And that launched into great conversations and just starting to figure, okay, like, what is this? Like, it feels really cool, but I also don't understand it. And, you know, just trying to understand also how to fit in what I'd been told growing up. Because, again, with particularly my mom growing up Baptist in Orange County, she had... And she grew up there before Vatican II. So she had Catholic friends in her public school and all that, and they would have sleepovers, and they would say the rosary, and she would say, "Why are you saying that?" And their answer was, "I don't know." And so her impression of Catholics is that these are people who have a whole bunch of shoulds, and they go through the motions, and they don't really get what they're doing. Because tradition. That's what her friends... experience of Catholicism was when she was a kid, while she's going to Bible schools where it's like you're memorizing verses and you're talking about, you know, articles of faith and, you know, all this kind of like that kind of Protestantism. It's like, you better know what you believe.
Because,
you know, and also during the Cold War, people would say, you know, if somebody held a gun to your head and said, "Do you believe in Jesus? What answer would you give?" And, you know, like, yeah, that was kind of the world that she grew up in.
Wow.
And so I had not necessarily a negative view, but...
After a brief intermission, we're back. I always think, like, maybe I can edit it to sound like it was. I'm like, it's more authentic this way.
Yeah.
It's more, it's fun.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's like you're in the room with us.
Yeah.
but
so just to, return to where we were talking about, what I'd known about Catholicism growing up. It wasn't a negative view, but it was just, I didn't know what to make of Catholics.
Right, it seemed like tradition for tradition's sake.
Yeah, and I hadn't met people who could really show me otherwise. And then, you know, I met my wife, who knew the Bible really well, and, you know, we were at a school where we were taking Bible classes and philosophy of religion and all this kind of stuff. And so, you know, there was a lot for us to process together, a lot for us to figure out, you know, where we agree and disagree. And... I think that's always been a really important part of our relationship, is just because we had to talk through, here's what I actually believe, and then listening very intently to the other person and, you know, okay, so what does that mean in practice for you? And, you know, how does your faith relate to others in the world and all of this? It became a much richer, like being... a Christian became richer for having that relationship in my life. I had to figure out so much of myself in order for the relationship to work. So that was...
Right. It really had to be intentional.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think I want to go back in a second to the long distance of it all, because I've so been there. But I'm curious. I think this will inform how you went into your relationship.
Mm-hmm.
When you were growing up, what did religious practice feel like for you? What were your first memories of church, of holidays, family tradition?
Yeah. So a big thing is hymn singing. Both my parents played the piano. My dad actually had been a music minister for his church when he was a teenager.
Wow.
He actually went to college on a music scholarship. Sang in a men's quartet. He sang opera. He was the kind of pastor who, if the organist was out sick, he would take over the organ. Like, it just...
Oh, wow.
Really musically gifted. And
so cool.
And so we grew up singing a lot of hymns from various traditions. And I can also remember a lot of folks hanging around in our house. Like, people just, you know, coming over for a barbecue or... people making a lot of us kids. You know, I had a sister who was 2 years younger. And so, you know, just being the pastor's kids, it's kind of where we were always kind of the center of attention in some ways. And, you know, there were downsides to that. But I remember a lot of upsides to that I was included very and, you know, got used to talking to grown-ups pretty early on, because like everybody gives you that extra attention when you're in that kind of situation. And also growing up watching my dad preach, I think that's one thing that has gone into my life as a professor is just having that role model of not only someone who really cares for people. My dad was just amazingly empathetic, one of the best listeners I've ever known, incredible pastoral heart, but he was also a really good public speaker. And so having that modeled for me meant that I could get nervous, but I never doubted that I could do that. Whether that was in an academic setting, if that was in more of a community setting, moving into my job, that was, one of the special things that I carried from that. I would say, because I also feel that, this can very easily start to sound like, a life of, nothing but triumphs and moving from strength to strength and all this kind of thing. And, one of the things that also was very formative for me in a negative way was we had a huge youth group at the Presbyterian church I went to in high school, like over 100 kids every week.
Wow.
It was big. And this was also at a church that had like 5 services every week. We would now consider it probably a mega church. Mm-hmm. The youth pastor was very charismatic, had done a lot to build up that group. He was also a control freak and he had a temper and you could get on his bad side. And, my sister got on his bad side a number of times. It was very traumatic for her. I actually didn't know about a lot of this until years after, where he would yell at her, criticize her, body shame her, like all kinds of stuff.
Jeez.
And, the big thing with this youth group that was their kind of signature thing they did was most of the youth group also participated in a youth choir that would spend every spring break going on choir tour around Southern California. And, we go to Disneyland and we go to, a bunch of different churches and beautiful locations and, all this different kind of thing. And my junior year, the choir director quit like 2 months before the tour was supposed to happen. Turns out because she could not stand working with the youth pastor. And my dad got hired in to take the plate because he was a musician. He was, someone who was interested in doing that. And he did a fantastic job. And people loved him. And it very quickly started to create sparks between him and the youth pastor.
Yikes.
And I can remember my senior year, it just kept getting worse and worse and worse and worse. Oh. And there was one day after a choir practice where I had stayed behind with my dad. My mom and sister had gone home together and I was going to ride home with my dad. And he and the youth pastor got into a shouting match with each other, which turned into basically the youth pastor just haranguing my dad for like 5 minutes in front of me. And so by the time I went off to college, I was like, okay, I need to rebuild my relationship with the church. And one of the nice things about going to a Christian college was that you could kind of hide out from being in a congregation for a little while because it's kind of like you almost live in a congregation.
We had
chapel services every week. I'm taking Old Testament, New Testament courses with all my classmates and, all these different kinds of things. And so I had places to process that without all the psychological effort of trying to be in a church congregation at the time. For my sister, it basically meant I'm done with the church. But she was not done with her faith. And so for her, that meant she had a couple of friends who got into Messianic Judaism, basically practicing Jewish liturgy, Jewish theology, but incorporating the New Testament, which is as hard as it sounds. it's quite something.
Right. I can't even imagine. I've actually never met a person who practices Messianic Judaism.
Yeah. So this part of the country, it's again where there's a certain, I would say experimentalism when it comes to religion that maybe is a little more West Coast than East Coast.
That sounds right, yeah.
One of the more active Messianic congregations I know of in this region is up in New Haven.
Interesting.
Not sure how many of those folks are Yaleys or associated with it, but it's like, it seems like one of those places where there's a lot of religious dialogue going on in many different ways in Yale and in New Haven. So, just thinking about that, that very uneasy place was where she wound up going. And I remember years later, my dad had, wasn't so much he had taken the role, but the role took him, where he after he left the pastorate in my sixth grade year, he'd spent a number of years, he'd been a bookstore manager, he went back to elementary school teaching, became a principal. I call him the liberal arts poster child. He was going to be a history professor originally, and then he wound up not being That's a history funny. Professor, doing all these other things instead. But he kind of fell into being an assistant pastor at his church. Mm-hmm. And he was really kind of agonizing about it at one point, because there is a passage in, let's see if I'm remembering right, that part of it is in 1 Timothy and part of it is in Titus, in Paul's letters, where it talks about the requirements of being a leader or a minister in a church. And one of them is leading your family in the faith. And for him, he was really having a hard time, because by this point, I had joined the Catholic Church and was attending there with my family. Wow. My sister had become a Messianic Jew. And so he was like, have I failed? Like, did I just not raise you in the way that would encourage you to stay in the church? And both my sister and I independently wound up sitting down with him and say, look, Dad, we chose harder things than staying where we were would have been as we went into our adulthood. And there were various things that triggered that. But either sticking to the status quo or giving up on it would have been easier than what either of us had chosen. And we would not have chosen these things if you had not taught us to love Jesus.
Yeah.
And so that's like everyone in the family is still 100% dedicated to Jesus is our Lord and Savior. He has shown us how to love God, love the people around us, love our planet. And that is what we're committed to. And the way that we express it and the people that we keep company with while we're expressing it look different.
Right.
But it's all getting back to the same commitment.
Yeah. Right.
And so eventually I think, you know, he was, you know, able to accept that.
And I guess it's not like he could have done anything differently. And right. He would have, you know.
Yeah, because kids are going to do what they're going to do.
Right. Like, if he had practiced or led differently, he would have changed your mind. Like, that's just not.
Yeah.
Huh. Yeah, that's so tough.
Yeah.
That's so interesting. He ended up. So was he. Is that what he did? You know, was that his most recent?
That was, yeah, basically his retirement job.
Yeah.
So it had started out being a choir director, and then people just started figuring out, hey, you're good at this, you're good at this. He filled in preaching a couple of times. They loved his preaching. And so his name was Richard. He went by Dick most of his life. And so he was Pastor Dick. And he passed away suddenly, right at freshman move-in in 2018. And that was a very, very hard time, but also a great time for me to start to take stock of what his legacy for me was. Yeah. And, you know, realizing that my love for learning, my love for God, you know, wanting to be a person of faith, and, you know, keeping that while pursuing an academic career, like that a lot of that was because of him. Mm. And, you know, even the fact that now I have mainly trained in early American literature. I focus mostly in poetry, and I do a lot with the history of reading. One of the things that I went into about 10 years ago was studying hymns as a form of poetry. And that's where I have moved some into looking at the history of Jewish hymnody as well as Christian hymnody, looking at a bunch of different traditions, and now writing a literary theory of how hymns work as poetry, which I'm really, really enjoying. But yeah, so a lot of that was because of him. And the first book I published on that was essentially a material history of collections of hymns that were published without music, which was much, much more common, say, before 1880 in the English-speaking world. And what people did with those. So it was very much a, you know, book history, thinking of how these are designed, thinking of, you know, what people do within a home, a church, all these different kinds of things. And my parents had actually been reading it to each other, and they finished the book the night my dad passed away, like just a few hours before. So that for me was also a key part of, you know, just realizing how special it is that we got to share that. Wow. And that, you know, my academic pursuits and my spiritual pursuits do have really important overlaps because of where I've been in my life.
Yeah. And wow. I find it so incredibly beautiful and valuable and vulnerable to talk about grief. Yeah. I think it's so core to who we are, but so something that's often stigmatized. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, thank you so much for sharing about that.
Yeah.
I'm curious, where do you feel your dad's legacy most today?
I would say the biggest thing that I would say pretty much across the whole time since his death, it was very clear to me very early on. I mean, grief is infamously incapacitating. Okay. And I was stepping in that year to my first semester as assistant head of my department. I was on a plane to California after getting the phone call when I was supposed to be greeting my posse I was mentoring who were just moving into their dorms.
Oh.
And wound up talking with them once I got back and just kind of, you know, say, here's what happened, here's how it's affecting me, and, you know, I want you to know I'm here for you and I'm also going through this. What I figured out very quickly was my capacity for doing most things was really, really low that semester.
Yeah,
the one thing I could do was listen, which again was my dad's kind of superpower.
Wow.
He would adopt people just all over the place. I remember my very first academic conference, I was a junior in college, and I'd gotten into this all undergraduate political science conference because that was one of my other majors. And
wow.
There was this other guy we'd never met before, went to a completely different school. I don't think he was even on my panel, but just, you know, we were going to each other's panels during the day and we had lunch and all this. And he just started talking to my dad, and they were in regular touch until the day my dad died. And he was a first-generation college student, came from a Mexican-American family, became a political science professor, moved around the country to various positions over the years, had a lot of, you know, faced a lot of racism in his field over the kinds of things he wanted to study. People say, well, you know, you're not really doing true political science. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just really, really frustrating things. And my dad was basically his counselor through a lot of that. And I had friends in college, similar kind of thing, like where my dad became more of a dad to them than their biological dads were. And he would just, yeah, it was like he would get a latte at Starbucks and someone would just start talking to him.
And they could tell.
And he, yeah, like he just had this, you know, aura about him. Like he talked to me and things will be kind of okay. And, you know, it was even something he did for some of my professors at times, you know, at his memorial service. You know, a lot of us from my college years were back together. And one of my dearest mentors was there and talked about, yeah, like your dad would always be there for me, would always just, you know, tell me that he was praying for me. And he said, and you always knew, just hearing it in his voice, that he had just been deep in prayer for it right before doing that. And so for me, it's that listening quality mm-hmm. that has really carried that over. And so as I was, you know, growing into being a posse mentor, being a department leader, these kinds of things, it's like, well, what I can offer you is that I can listen and I can be here for you in that way. And that's been something I've really kind of cultivated in myself from that time. To the point where even recently I mentioned to my wife, I said, yeah, I think I now go through the same sign on my face that my dad had. It's like, you know, you can come listen, you can come talk to me, and I'm a good listener. And it's one of those things where it's not always great for time management, but it is really, really cool to see that, you know, how that becomes a key part of my identity. And again, going back to faith, I've thought a lot about that as a form of hospitality, which again, as an extroverted introvert, it's like, well, I'm not big on throwing parties. Sure. I'm not big on, like, you know, let's get 50 people together and we're just going to have an amazing time. I'm happy to go to those things when other people put them together. Sure. And then I can leave. But to realize that this is a kind of hospitality that I can right. offer, that's something that is really special to me.
That's your gift.
Yeah.
That's such a beautiful thing that so many people don't have. They don't have the capacity for real intimacy, you know, one-on-one connection like that. It's a very special, generous thing. I was telling you last week, but just when you first met me and you said, even if you don't end up at Lafayette, you know, stay in touch, I'll do whatever I can. I thought, not many people are that generous. It's a beautiful thing. And I think that's so beautiful that it was informed by your faith and mm-hmm. by your dad. Wow. And I'm curious too about his role and your mom's role and any other important people in your mm-hmm. early life. And in that decision, that first major decision, right, of mm-hmm. going to the Christian college.
Yep.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a good question. Yeah. So, part of what led me that direction was, again, I had, even though there were traumas in going through my youth group, I had some amazing friends mm-hmm. in that group, and also some amazing mentors, you know, folks in their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, who would come alongside us in the group and just, you know, be there for us in a lot of different ways, you know, everything from the, you know, the mom who always baked for people to, you know, the dad who would get a group of, you know, 13, 14-year-olds together to talk about, okay, like, if you're growing into leaders, what does it mean to be a leader if you're a Christian? And, you know, things like that. And, yeah, just seeing this really dynamic intergenerational life. When I visited the campus that I wound up going to, I felt something very similar to that, that this is a place where I could find peers that I can really connect with. I sat in on a class with someone who became another one. I had so many amazing mentors in college. It was so cool. And and he stayed and talked with me for like 15 minutes after class. Aww. And, you know, we had financially hit some hard times at that particular point. And, you know, another thing that kind of opened doors for me was on the FAFSA, I qualified for everything.
Wow.
You know, Pell eligible, state grants, federal, like all kinds of different stuff, because my dad had been out of work most of that mm-hmm. year. And one of the things that I had also been thinking about, like I could have applied for application waivers and just couldn't bring myself to do that. And so I applied to University of California campuses because, those are cheap and those are, you know, with in-state tuition and everything. Okay. I can handle that. And then I applied to this one liberal arts college, this Christian school. And I had been on a couple of the UC campuses. And honestly, I was not feeling it. But yeah. UC campuses, almost all of them were built in the 60s. There's a lot of concrete. Yes, some of them are right on a beach, and some of them are in really pretty farmland, and still, it's just like...
It's not you.
No, like, I don't know where I would find myself in a place like that. Mm-hmm. And when the financial aid came through to go to Westmont, it's like, okay, yeah, this is really what I want. This is really where I want to be. And it was one of those things where... The faith part was important, but it was the home sense that really made the biggest difference.
Right, community.
That knowing that this was a place where I could find my people, where I could more or less be okay. It was 300 miles away from home.
Wow.
And so that was a big step. Turns out my parents, I hadn't realized that I had grown up in the Sacramento area, and they hated it. Middle of the Central Valley, it's like 100 for a lot of the summer. It's dry, it's dusty, terrible allergies, which my dad especially suffered from a whole lot. Mm. And so basically, once I had managed to get to a Southern California campus, they were like, all right, this is it. We're
like our and excuse.
So, yeah, right. So freshman year, I was 300 miles from home. By sophomore year, I was 30 miles from home. They moved back to the town in Ventura County that they had started out their marriage in.
Mom
still lives. So that was, it was a big change. It was a change that kind of kept changing, partly because of that. Then my sister wound up coming to the same college, and, we had to figure out how to be on this small campus together. And that was its own. Particularly as she was working through her stuff and I was working through my stuff. And we weren't so sure we wanted to work through our stuff together. I would say our friendship deepened a lot in our 20s, but, that was an interesting time for us.
Man, that's really good to hear.
Yeah.
I would love that. How did that feel? What led to your friendship deepening?
Part of it was us starting to realize what each other's paths might really look like. When you're growing up with a sibling, a lot of times, like, you see what they're interested in, you start to think, okay, maybe they're going to go in this direction, maybe they're going to go in that direction, but they're still just them.
Yeah.
And, when you mostly see each other when you're back in your home, or, maybe some family activities or something like that, it's like you don't really get to see them in a lot of new contexts. And in college, it was, maybe a little too close for comfort at times. We also found plenty of things that we could do on our own, so it wasn't like, we couldn't escape each other. There were a lot of ways that we both found really good places to be in college. But once we got past that and I started to go down the academic route, she started to get much more into the arts, and then exploring things like ministry. She was considering cantorial school, a lot of those kinds of things.
Yeah.
We both started to realize, oh, this is who you're growing up into.
Aww.
And like, I find you interesting, and I know because we have all this background, I also know kind of what, if it makes sense to say, what it cost you to build this for yourself?
I think so, yeah.
And so I think it was being able to reach that stage of recognition where it's like we're not physically in each other's space. Like, we've never lived in the same town ever since I graduated from college. But we've been there for each other through a lot of different things, and we've seen a lot of very difficult and painful times, and we've also seen some pretty amazing wins. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that she could be there for me, I could be there for her while all that was going on, really became a key part of how we learned to be adults. And I would say I actually figured out how to be an adult sibling faster than I learned how to be an adult
in general?
Child.
No.
Like an adult son of my parents.
Yeah. Oh, that's so interesting. And I guess it had to be, your friendship had to be an independent unit from your being siblings.
It did, almost. Yeah. And I think, again, this is where, again, our divergent faith traditions may also have had something to do with that. Because that's something that we've always been able to kind of go back to as, for us, it was never a matter of challenge. It was, you know, just, okay, explain this to me, or, tell me what's going on with this. And so for some of what that's grown into is, say, for this book that I'm working on right now, where I'm thinking about hymns as a form of poetry, the first chapter is actually on the Psalms as a form of poetry. Mm-hmm. And I have had great conversations with her where, you know, some of her precantorial study, other things that she's looked into, like she's taught herself a fair amount of Hebrew and can get, you know, to a pretty good depth with a number of the kind of, you know, studying of the Psalms and, you know, all this kind of thing. And we've been able to share a lot of really interesting perspectives through that. And that's been, you know, really particularly important because that chapter, I think, was one of the first big academic things I wrote after my dad died.
Wow.
And so for the two of us to be able to share that,
yeah,
in a way that, you know, I would have been able to share with him. He loved talking through my work in progress with me. But for my sister, just realizing that she has her own identity. She has her own expertise and her own perspective that I can actually learn from.
Hmm.
Both at a personal level, but also, like, this is making a difference in my academic work.
Oh.
And for her, growing up in a family where we were inundated with books. Like I said, you know, we had a parent, you know, parents collectively had 4 master's degrees between them. It's like,
wow.
You know, we had a lot of education going on. And so for her to also reach that point where she didn't choose an academic career for herself, but she has that ability and gets to use that with me, I think has been a really great thing for us to share.
I was going to say, really? So she now is a practicing, like, clergy person, like a...
Well, she's put that on hold, more or less, at this point, basically because she ran into, as a woman, getting into a Messianic cantorial school was very difficult. It turns out that Messianic Judaism... So a lot of people assumed that what she was a part of was Jews for Jesus, which is a...
Is that not...
It's very... well, it's very evangelical, not just in terms of the culture of it, but it's also very evangelistic in terms of it's, you know, people who claim Jewish identity, but they are looking to convert people.
Yeah.
Messianic Jews are not interested in converting.
Oh, interesting.
Which is... It's both a beautiful thing about that tradition, but also something that makes things rather difficult because it's like, okay, everybody who's a part of that community is from somewhere else.
Oh, really?
And if you're not actively recruiting,
yeah,
how do you keep it going?
Right, because it's funny. I remember learning that, you know, not Messianic Judaism, that back in the day, 1,000+ years ago, we did used to kind of recruit a little more. And it blew my mind. It's I can't even picture it.
Yeah.
You know, the whole thing with Judaism, you know, I've seen a couple of people convert.
Mm-hmm.
You have to get rejected 3 times. It's such an
yeah.
arduous, difficult process. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, no, we don't want you. No, like, go away. Come back again if you feel like it, but only if you feel like it, if you really feel compelled.
Yeah.
Yeah, I always thought Messianic Judaism and Jews for Jesus were synonymous.
Yeah, they're close together, but not the same thing. And this is, again, where... Because people are from somewhere else, you do have people who have been part of other parts of Judaism, more often conservative rather than reform.
Really?
And then if they're former Christians, they tend to be out of evangelical circles.
Oh.
And so a lot of the gender norms reflect those communities that people have come out of, which means there are Messianic seminaries. They're quite small and they're all male.
Wow. Yeah. Right. Because I don't know why I had this idea that they were kind of hippy dippy, whatever. Like,
well, I think Jews for Jesus can get that way, partly because it is, it's a particular kind of syncretism, whereas evangelicalism has developed more of the, like, you know, the pastor can wear jeans and, you know, all that kind of side to it. It's absorbed that. Messianic Judaism hasn't really.
Interesting.
Like the rabbi will still wear a prayer shawl.
Sure.
And, you know, the cantor will still, if not in full liturgical dress, will have something approaching that. There's still a fair amount of singing that's done in Hebrew as well as English. Mm-hmm. It's again an uneasy space to be in, and it's especially uneasy if you're a woman, which is what my sister has found out.
Oh, that's tough.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, right, because I was going to say, this was when I thought, you know, she was going to be a clergy person. I feel like there's so much overlap. There is something very academic about being a clergy person.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Now, the amount of study you have to do in order to teach, in order to lead worship,
I mean, that's why I didn't become a rabbi. I really thought about it. I love leading services. I'm very passionate about it. It fulfills me and everything. I was like, I don't want to do 7 more years of school.
Yeah, no, that is that's big
commitment. So many years. That's way too many. Wow. But that's just so interesting. And then it really feels like because you had these differences that actually made you closer because you could learn from one another.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, and that feels like it was the same with your wife.
Very much so.
Yeah.
And that for her, you know, one of the things that we have wound up having to navigate together, and I think having a multi-denominational, multi-faith way of doing this has been really important, is I would say it's been increasingly difficult for us to be Catholic over the last 10 years or so. I started to notice this, I would say around 2012, you know, I feel like I can pinpoint it pretty easily because I was in a men's prayer group, which I loved being a part of over at St. James. I was, except for the son of the guy who started the group who had passed away before I joined it, I was the youngest one there by probably close to 20 years.
That's the best.
But it's like, I wanted a group of men to pray with. These, you know, these men were incredible supports through various things that I and my family have gone through. We've had, you know, just a lot of important times together. But 2012 was when I first started to notice, you know, people would say, well, you know, you can't really be Catholic and vote for Obama. And so my initial reaction to that was, okay, I'm not going to touch this. Yeah. I'm just going to kind of, you know, let things...
Church and state, you know.
Yeah. It's like, I'm here to pray and, you know, we'll just kind of deal with it. And it was something that would come up every now and then and then what would fade out. I felt like it started to get a lot tougher around Ferguson and a lot of the, you know, what would turn into the Black Lives Matter protests in like 2014, 2015, and then leading into the 2016 election. Oh my word. And, you know, and then when it got to Biden, where, you know, I'm hearing so many people at my church saying, this man is not a Catholic. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, he goes to Mass. He's grown up in the church.
What else do you want?
It's like, you know, it's like, it's all there. And they're like, but he's pro-choice. And then that, you know, that's the end. You know, his immigration stance is wrong. And, you know, all this other. And it's, you know, I can't even deal with this. And then, you know, in the middle of all that, the Pennsylvania grand jury investigation into sexual abuse in the church comes out, and that is just that was a tidal wave for us. We were like, this is so, I cannot believe that this is what we have to deal with as a community. And, you know, and for me it was the The original actions were horrific. The covering up actually hurt more.
Oh, yeah.
You know, just real, like, you can't admit to this horrendous sin that's tearing our community apart while you're berating these various political sins and, you know, all these other things that, and, the thing that finally broke it, felt like we hung on for a really long time, and it basically came down to COVID. And when churches in this area started to come back, St. James decided they were not going to continue their video mass, so you couldn't participate virtually. Participating virtually in the mass is a little bit odd anyway, because the whole thing revolves around the Eucharist rite, and
it, right, you're and not then you can't do that virtually.
Yeah, yeah. And but then they also, this was before a vaccine for kids was available, and they said, well, for masking, we'll just ask everybody to use their common sense. And it's like, we knew, because they've been saying it on social media, we knew there were people in the church who were not getting the vaccine. We knew that people were not masking, you know, all this kind of stuff. And it's like, we had three of our four children baptized in this church, and now you're saying that you're not going to bother to make it safe for us
value
to
their lives. Yeah.
And that was where, by the time it came to that, it took us about 30 minutes to make the decision. Like, we cannot be here anymore.
30 minutes.
Yeah, it was one of those, like, it a long time.
I was gonna say,
and then
building
all at once. It's kind of like the Berlin Wall.
And
it went away. Like, what happened? And, you know, and we had found out in the meantime that College Hill Press was doing mandatory masking. Mm-hmm. And again, we had a number of friends who were that, some who had left there and had come back, and we're telling it, like, you've got to give it another try. Like, this is just a great community. And yeah, when we came back, it was not only being welcomed, but also that sense that we're all working to keep each other safe.
Right.
And so even as eventually the masking eased and, you know, other kinds of things, it's like, this church showed us its true colors. Mm-hmm. And this is where this is where we want to be. This is where, you know, we want our kids to grow up with these people.
Care.
You know, and that was, I think, in some ways the most painful thing on the Catholic side, was just, I was starting to get to the point, say a few months before we finally made the decision. What if one of my kids comes up to me and said, I don't get why we're Catholic, and I don't want to be Catholic because of all these, you know, just really, really painful political things. And I was like, I don't think I have an answer for you. I'm here because I made a commitment, but that's my commitment and not yours.
Right.
And so just realize, you know, I had basically kind of gone up to the edge of that tragedy of realizing that, you know, I cannot give my kids a good reason for staying in the church.
It lost its attention.
Yeah.
It lost its care. This is where I always get frustrated with, you want to call yourself pro-life,
mm-hmm,
and then
yep,
not value lives.
Yeah.
Yeah, that must have been so heartbreaking. This church you've been for so long.
Yeah.
And it weathered so many storms with you, and you built this community, and it kind of abandoned you.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm so curious. Have you ever read Tim Alberta's books?
I have not.
Oh, my gosh. This is reminding me so much of his most recent book, came out within 2023, and it's all, you would love this, it's all about Trumpism and in evangelical America. And it's fascinating. It's why does that flock to everyone? Why, you know, was anti-masking such a thing?
Yeah.
Why? And the exact same pinpoints that you were talking about, you know, with Black Lives Matter in 2013 and 14, mm-hmm, and with 2016, 2020, and just how it continually got worse and it built on itself.
Yeah.
And this cult of personality and the comparison of Trump to Jesus and everything, you know, it's just wild.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, the religious iconography just keeps getting weirder and weirder.
Yeah, but Tim Alberta also is a pastor's kid. And
okay.
There's just, I think you'd love that. And he wrote a book, I believe, 4 years ago as well. Mm. But this most recent one is the one I read. And really just, there's so much of an overlap.
Yeah.
I mean, it's funny. People talk about divorcing religion and politics, and mm-hmm. I don't think you can.
No. I mean, there's as much as we like to think of the wall between church and state in the United States, it's never really been there.
No.
I'm trying to remember the name of the author of a book I read in 2016 that, like, I read it in, like, a day. It just sucked me in, even though it was a fairly dry nonfiction book. It was on Christianity and White America.
Yeah.
And the basic thesis was that Christianity and whiteness have always been really important partners in American history. Mm-hmm. And as starting with certain denominations have shrunk, and then overall Christian presence in the country has shrunk, and as the white population has become a smaller and smaller percentage of the overall population, there's been this increased association between Christianity and whiteness, but it's also losing its hold on more and more of the population. And the key thing that the author was looking at was the 2012 election, where Romney's campaign had traded in a lot of the standard white Christian tropes that were available at that time. You know, they've since gotten a lot more intense, but, like, they've been there for a really long time. Oh, like, they were there for Reagan, they were there for Nixon. It's like, you know, they were there for Eisenhower. It's like, you know, this has just been a thing for a very long time. And his campaign hit all of their benchmarks for, you know, we need this much of North Carolina, we need this much of that in order to win the Electoral College game. And they hit all their benchmarks and failed because the white Christian vote just was not big enough anymore.
Wow.
And so the book ended with a prediction saying, all right, we're about to go one of two ways. One is that white Christianity is just going to start fading in relevance and will become less of a political force, less of a cultural force, or there is going to be one last cataclysmic push that the white church will not recover from. Like, they will lose so much of the next generation, they will lose so much of, you know, what might have been other allies before, that this will be the end of white Christianity as an institution. But in terms of, you know, playing a large role in the American public, but basically they're going to take as much down with them as they can.
Right. That's definitely what's happening. Yeah. I mean, they are very much a vocal minority, you know? Mm-hmm. But that must have been such a wild shift, though, starting to go back to College Presby.
Yeah.
And now it's been 3-4 years, right?
Yeah.
And how has that felt leaning into that new community? What have the benchmarks and milestones been like there?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think a big part of it is how we've seen our kids' comfort level. So it was like they were used to Mass. Mm-hmm. There wasn't really a problem there. But there also wasn't a ton of connection.
Yeah.
One of the things that I have absolutely loved at College Hill Presbyterian, and this is, we have a few folks on the faith formation staff there, basically Christian education for younger folks that have just worked so hard to make this, you know, a really welcoming place for the kids, is that there's a lot more play-based interaction, so that rather than traditional Sunday school, it's like, okay, we'll read through the Bible story, we'll talk about, you know, the Bible story and things like that, but we're also going to just spend a lot of time being friends together. The pre-church Sunday school program they renamed Wild and Holy,
where
it basically is a playtime, and you know, with some faith element introduced at some point, but the idea is that the kids are just going to get time with each other, and they're going to, you know, also get time with the adults and know that, okay, these are people who are here to, you know, make sure that I'm all right, that I can have a good time with, and all this kind of thing. And so the kids, especially our younger ones, have really gotten attached to that. At the same time, our oldest has reached this fit. He's been very science-minded pretty much from the beginning. And he's right now at this point where religion doesn't make logical sense. And so he had declared himself an atheist a couple of years ago. And
we're
like, you know, that's big. Yeah. We love you for that. You know, we support that. You're still going to church with us because, you know, there's belief in
the
practice.
Family, right.
And, like, while you're living at home, like, this is what our family's practice is. He doesn't like that very much, but, you know, he goes along with it. And
does he still feel any connection to the people, the community?
To a few of the people.
Okay.
And this is where, you know, again, he has tried to keep a distance, and he actually gets annoyed when people come up to him and say, you know, I just want you to know I'm thinking about you, or something like that. But it's part of the marvelous thing, you know, it's the first time in my life, in my adult life, certainly, that I've been part of a neighborhood church. Like, we can walk to church.
Awesome.
Like, that's, you know, I can walk to work, I can walk to church. I feel like I'm living, like, a century in the past.
It's amazing. We're at college.
It's so cool. And, yeah, so the fact that he knows neighbors who also go to the church, and so there are other places where he can interact with them. One of them actually is a math, a middle school, high school math teacher who has been writing his own math curriculum in the summers for a number of years, and our son has been beta testing that for him. And you know, he had a really slow start to high school, wasn't really sure what he wanted to do, realized that he wanted to go into certain kinds of material science and that you need a degree for that. And he said, oh, I need to get going. And so he starts cranking with this math, and he uses our friend's math curriculum. And so he's friends with that person in our church because of the math connection. And so it's like he finds his ways to keep going with that. But yeah, it's one of these where I don't know what his path is going to look like going forward, but the big thing for us has been, again, you know, we will support you in any way that we can, and, you know, we're here to talk through things, puzzle through things with you, leave you alone if that's what you need. You still are going to church with us, but it's like...
I was gonna say, like, what are those conversations like? You know, like... When he first told you, did he ever ask, you know, like, how can God and science exist at the same time?
A lot of it he was processing in his own head and stayed really kind of quiet about. And that when he did bring it to us, there was this, I need to tell you this because it's the truth, but I'm really worried that you're going to be mad at me. Partly because I think he hadn't seen a ton of it, but he'd seen some of, like, how my parents in particular had wrestled a little bit with my own faith journey. Like, you're marrying a Catholic, and what does this actually mean? And, like, you know, how are you still a Christian? And, you know, all this kind of thing that, you know.
Oh, they didn't view Catholicism as Christianity.
Well, they didn't understand what it meant for me to be a Christian at that. Like, are you still a Christian the way that we had always understood you had been for, say, your first 20-some-odd years? Or are you something different now? And it's basically, no, I'm still the same. I just, you know, have some different practices, different communities, and yeah, also I think some different beliefs. You know, for me, one of the things becoming Catholic, and this is something that I think it's harder to bring this up with my son because this is not how Presbyterians operate, but when I joined the Catholic Church, there were a number of things I still had questions about, and the reason why I felt comfortable joining at that point was that, okay, I feel led to be part of this community. There, you know, a lot of things that really nourish me, are important to me about being here. I don't have everything figured out, but one of the things I had come to understand about Catholicism is
you don't need to.
That, you know, it's both. There is trying to find a softer word than submission, but I think submission is actually a really important word in the Catholic Church, because there is this sense of, well, I am me living out my conscience in the best way that I can, but there is this thing that is bigger than me, called the Church, which is a human institution, but it's also divinely ordained, that is kind of providing some rails for kind of how my faith gets acted out. And the other kind of weird corollary to that is the reason that that doesn't make everybody lockstep is that Catholicism is also really great at winking at difference, in the sense that, you don't 100% believe in papal infallibility. That's okay. Like, you know, don't stand up and announce it in the middle of church, but we can work with that. And so this was one of the things that had been so frustrating about these later political developments, was there was this, like, you can disagree with a whole bunch of things and still be Catholic. Like, there's a certain, the poet Keats had this term, negative capability, being able to hold seeming opposites as true in your head at the same time. Like, Catholicism has a capacity to do that I have not seen in a lot of other Christian communities.
Yeah, because I was going to say, that's my favorite thing about Judaism. You know, it's really, it's kind of like, what? This is funny. You know, there's a program that Disciple Makers does called Dial for a Donut, right?
They'll
go around. you text, you ask a question about Jesus, and you get a donut.
Yeah.
Great. And people, when I was president of Hillel, would ask me, like, Lisa, why doesn't Hillel do that? I'd be like, well, we'd be talking for 4 hours. Like, there kind of is no quick answer to things. You know, it's kind of like, well, here's what I personally believe. Here's what this random rabbi from 1,000 years ago believes. Here's what this rabbi from 600 years ago believes. Here's what my friend believes. And they're all right and they're all wrong.
Right. You know, and here's some stories to kind of
fill in the blanks. Yeah. Right. No, exactly. It's just nothing is that cut and dry, and that's kind of cool.
And so to me, this is, you know, one of the things that was most important to me about Catholicism was that, you know, James Joyce had this famous line that Catholicism means here comes everybody.
That
kind of was like, it's like openly their official position on various things, but there are various ways to hold certain political beliefs. There are ways to hold certain identities in the church, and it's like, you know, do we want the church to change on things like gay rights? Yes. Do we want the church to change on contraception? Yes. Like, you know, there are just various things like, but it's like, you can still be Catholic and disagree about those things. And it felt like about 10 years ago that stopped being as true, at least in the American church, as it used to be. And so I think that, and you know, that has afflicted probably just about any religious organization we can name in the last, like, the last 10 years have been so hard on religion in general.
It's so hyper-polarizing.
Yeah.
So, right, just people all feel the need to agree or ostracize. Yeah, God, that's tough, but it sounds like now you've gotten to a, you know, not to quote Lafayette, but you've gotten to a place of and.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. And I think another part of that is that particularly the current pastor, and I think the one before him as well, had took a good line on this, that this is a place where we can disagree.
Yeah. I
love that. This is not a Democrat church. This is not a Republican church. Right. This is not a, you must understand things in a certain way or you're no good. Like, there are people who, so College Hill Presbyterian, just as one example, has a long-standing connection with the local Salvation Army. Mm-hmm. And so people will be out ringing the bells at the Christmas season every year and all this kind of thing, you know, will be going on. And for some people, this is actually a really important point. How you take your faith out to the world is that you share in that particular social outreach. For other people, because of the Salvation Army stance on LGBTQ plus issues and things like that, it's like, no, that is not okay. But somehow we've made a space for, there are people who express their faith through being involved in the Salvation Army, and there are people who express their faith by taking a stand against the Salvation Army, and we're still in the same congregation.
Right.
And we don't spend a lot of time talking about it, which is part of how we make that work, but it's like people know where we stand on these things, and there isn't personal judgment brought into it. It's like, you know, I understand that you see this very differently than I do, and I understand that there are things that are very hard for you about what my commitment is, but I also appreciate the grace that you're extending, and I will extend grace in return.
Wow. That's really beautiful, because I just think that's something that people are so incapable of doing, especially when I think about just politics. I mean, people are so, either you agree on every single issue or you're out. That's really, and in religious communities as well. That's awesome. And I'm curious too, you know, when I think about the time you've spent, just the last few years since COVID was a thing. How is COVID and becoming department head and these different changes, has that impacted your relationship with faith? Has faith come into play in different ways there?
Oh, absolutely. So I would say, you know, one of the things that happened with COVID that I think was also getting me ready for department leadership was I've always had a bit of, again, this goes back to my introversion, a bit of, you might say, a monastic tendency. Like, I love being by myself and having my quiet time and, you know, all that kind of thing. And, you know, reading, you know, from the Bible, reading prayers, or, you know, some really cool book that's, you know, opening my perspective on something. And so did a lot of that during COVID. But then one of the things, I've actually talked with a friend of mine who became department chair at about the same time at a school in Missouri. And he and I came from, in some ways, quite similar backgrounds. His dad was actually a history professor at an evangelical school in Michigan. And I had actually met his dad through a conference years and years and years before I met his son. His son and I are now, you know, we've done collaborations. We see each other at conferences all the time. And it's really, really, but we've talked about this. How do you do this kind of work as a Christian? And he told me about one time talking with a group of his colleagues about servant leadership. And how weird that concept was to his secular colleagues, where to him, it was, this is second nature. Like, if you're going to be a leader, you're going to be a leader in a way that you humble yourself in doing that. You're here to serve others. You're not here to put yourself up. And that's a big part of where my faith has come into doing that kind of work. And it's been, it's also been important for how to process the failures and the tough times, where it's like, okay, I don't think I handled that well. And I don't think that I made the right choice there. You know, those different kinds of things, just to come to terms with my vulnerability a bit with it, and with my, my fallibility with all of that, just to, another colleague in another department half jokingly said to, but I think there's more than a grain of truth in it, that being department head is a great time to build character. And it's like you learn a lot about yourself. You learn a lot about where your limits are.
Working with people.
I think just, having that servant leader mentality, but then also just having some means to try to be honest with myself about how things are actually going. Like, yes, this thing is truly going well. Okay, this is not working. Okay, I was actually wrong about this thing. I thought it was right and it turns out it's wrong, or I thought it was wrong and it turns out it's right. Mm-hmm. And just kind of realizing that I don't know everything and that that's actually good.
You wouldn't want to.
Yeah.
You wouldn't want to.
Yeah.
Right. It, you know, then you wouldn't be able to change your mind about things.
Right. Yeah.
And where's the fun in that?
Yeah.
And it's such a challenge working with people. It's so fluid. Mm-hmm. And how is this person going to feel about this change? And how, yeah. No, I admire you so much. I can't imagine managing that much for many years, you know. That's awesome. Wow. Yeah. Well, I feel like we could talk about this for days. This has been just amazing. I love your story. Thank you for being so open and vulnerable and authentic. I'm so moved. And, is there anything else we haven't touched on that you'd like to before we wrap up?
Well, I would say just one thing, particularly thinking of kind of the part of campus that your initiative has come out of in doing Colton Corner is it has meant so much to me to have a vibrant, intentional religious and spiritual life program at this school, because that was, again, going from a little Christian college to a place like Stanford, that pretty much did worship itself. Like the church there was covered with stained glass windows from passages of the Bible, and then it had the sayings of Jane Stanford carved into the wall because she's the one who paid for it. Yeah, the founding couple, Leland and Jane Stanford. This was Mrs. Stanford's words of wisdom. Are literally carved in stone, every generation of Stanfordians can.
So that's God.
So there it was like, okay, like I have my church communities, I have my academic community. They basically have nothing to do with each other.
Right, right.
And then coming here, where it's like, okay, I need to find some way of making an integrated life
for myself.
And I love that that's actually been possible.
Oh, that's so great to hear. Because sorry.
No, go ahead.
Well, because I talk about this a lot. It's something I really care deeply about fixing. Mm-hmm. I think it's kind of a reason why I'm here on this planet, you know, where it's just religion is so often dismissed as non-academic and not important, and you're silly if it's something that's important to you. There are many people in my life who actually, some more antagonistically than others, have kind of made fun of me for my involvement in what I do. And then they'll see me do it.
Yeah.
And they'll see me actually lead. And they'll say, you know, you kind of changed my mind.
You know, That's awesome.
It's the best feeling in the whole world. And it's like, oh, I guess maybe there could be value to that. Mm-hmm. Because what I do when I lead services that I haven't seen many other people do, I will print things out. I will make notes. I will speak in between each prayer. Mm. And I'll say, here's what this means. Here's why we're doing it.
Cool.
Here's a personal connection for me to this one. And it's so important to me to make every time I do it unique and special and different. So it doesn't just feel like we're doing it for doing its sake.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something where, people in my life who aren't as mean as the people in my life I just mentioned, but who were like, you know, before I met you, I kind of thought religion was stupid, you know, like, and I saw you do it and I still maybe not sure it's really my thing, but I see it could have this power for good.
Yeah.
And I think we were talking about those communities that were taken over by being an anti-masker and things like that. Like, religion is so easy to co-opt, like any institution, so easy to be co-opted by these harmful movements.
Mm-hmm.
But when it's used to bring people together and for warmth and community and light, it's so meaningful. Thank you for saying that, really.
Yeah. Well, I think, folks like Alex Hendrickson, student leaders like you, really make the difference with a lot of that. And that's something I've seen for a long time. You know, when I got here and John Kolach was the chaplain, I already felt that. And then, having Alex with her leadership, just really make this a place where we can grow. in our faith. Like, okay. That's, you know, I think there's something that changed a bit when she got here that, you know, John and I are very, very good friends. He left to be chaplain of Bucknell. He's now retired and actually became a pastor of a Baptist church in his retirement. But he's an ordained Methodist. Like, he's got an interesting story,
that's
too.
So cool.
He spent a lot of his time here kind of butting his head against the wall of somewhere between hostility and indifference.
Yeah.
Like, no, this actually is really important to people. This is a really central part. And, you know, the higher ups are like, yeah. Just say the prayer at the invocation and you know, just
you
don't
know,
bother us.
Nicole Hurd has been amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. No, she's been really supportive.
President Hurd is a godsend, literally.
Yeah.
I mean, right. One of the first things she did when she got here is that she was interviewed by me.
Yeah.
I was just so, I couldn't imagine any other college president I've ever seen want to sit down and have a conversation like this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and she's really, it's genuine. She cares.
Yeah.
And she came back and prayed at the Hillel House with us after a vigil we had. It was so,
yeah.
It was beautiful. I thought, who else would do this?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's, you know, where I think we've started to see a culture change.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's also, honestly, you know, I was on the search committee for Ernest Jeffries, Vice President Jeffries.
Yes.
Bringing it in.
Amazing.
I mean, he wore it very lightly in the interview, but it's like, if you know how to look for it, you know, it's like, this is a man of faith, and it, you know, is shot through everything that he does. And it was one of the things that made him stand out to me, you know.
Absolutely.
And I saw some incredible people in that search process. I, you know, learned so much, saw so many incredible, but I thought, you know, I really want this person working with me on campus.
Yeah.
And part of it is that, you know, faith matters. And he knows, you know, deep in his brain and deep in his bones what that means.
Yes.
And that, you know, like, having people in leadership like that is so important in a place like this, where it's like, you know, yes, we are dedicated to the life of the mind, but the life of the mind doesn't survive without the life of the body and the life of the spirit.
And the soul.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. It's so funny, you know, you talk about meant to be and fate. Dr. Jeffries actually was the only candidate I saw for the position.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't able to come to any of the other meetings. But
yeah, it was a busy time.
Right.
As someone who was on the committee, it was a busy time.
But they asked, you know, student leaders to come if they could. And Alex said to me, could, you know, make sure you go to one. And that was the one I happened to be free for.
Mm-hmm.
And thank God.
Yeah.
He's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
He's so cool. Yeah, I just sat down with him a week ago, and maybe exactly a week ago, and right, we were talking about his life in music.
Yeah.
I mean, his musical religious connection to God
mm-hmm.
that motivated his academic work. It's just, it's really so wild that I ended up here, and I ended up discovering my own faith through these other people's.
Yeah, oh, I love that.
Oh, yeah. Thanks. Yeah, I mean, it's really, it's funny. I've been doing a lot of reflecting to write my baccalaureate speech, because
mm-hmm.
At first I thought, you know, how do you summarize 4 years in 5 minutes?
Right.
That's so hard.
Yeah.
But that's really what it came out to be, finding other people's voices and then realizing my own through that. And it was this kind of thing where I don't think, kind of what you were talking about, just the not really pausing to think about it when you're growing up. I think, you know, my Jewish identity was always so important to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I was so core to who I was. But when I got here, it became everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's something so special about this place. I think I really... I'm getting very sentimental, you know, these last couple
days.
Yeah,
no, it's the right time for it. It's,
yeah. But really, I'm so glad I got to spend this time with you and that we reconnected at the formal.
Yeah.
I'm really grateful. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you, Lisa. Yeah. And yeah, it's been so cool to see you just kind of shine a light on this side of our community in a way that no one had before. So,
really?
You know, I'm thrilled I get to, you know, help to, you know, start closing out the series.
Yay. Well, right. And I'm hoping it'll continue on next year.
Yeah.
But
yeah, that would be
to
great.
Be continued. Thank you so much for listening.